Welcome to the Choate Family Office podcast series. On this show, we explore important topics related to wealth management, investing, and managing risk across generations.
Hello, and thank you for joining our podcast about media streamers. My name is Hideyoshi Watanabe. I'm an investment analyst at Choate IA, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Jake Kidder. Jake is a portfolio manager and covers many media and entertainment companies for us. Welcome, Jake.
Thanks, Yoshi. Happy to be here.
Today, we're discussing the world of media streamers and exploring the evolving landscape and the strategies of these interesting companies. Media companies are just one small piece of the broader investment opportunity set. We believe that most clients know and use media streaming services, but we wanted to dig a little deeper and shed some light on the lesser known aspects of the industry. Jake, before we dive in, can you set the stage and describe what's a media streamer?
Sure. A media streamer is a platform used by an entertainment company to distribute their content directly to consumers, usually over the internet, through mobile devices and connected TVs. Popular streamers include Netflix, Disney Plus, and Warner Discovery's Max. Most of these platforms offer direct subscriptions to consumers, and several also bundle their platforms with other services at a discounted price. These streamers have proliferated over the last few years, and now nearly every legacy media company has launched their own platform.
This is a major shift in the media business. Maybe before we talk about the present, it'd be helpful to hear some background on how we got here. Would you mind walking us through some of the industry's history?
Yeah, absolutely. I break down the recent history into three periods to help provide context for how we got to the current state. The first period kicked off in the 1990s and continued into the 2000s. So I'll call this the cable bundle's heyday. By the late 2000s, roughly 90% of households in the U.S. subscribed to a paid TV subscription, either through cable or satellite. People were also watching an average of 5 to 6 hours of TV per day. This high demand from consumers and competition amongst cable providers allowed media companies to charge increasingly higher carriage fees for their growing offering of cable channels. Media companies then bundled their most popular channels, such as Disney's ESPN or Fox's Fox News, with less watched channels, and then forced the cable companies to negotiate carriage fees for the whole bundle. The media companies could then hold their valuable content hostage and not allow their popular channels to air until the cable company agreed to a higher total bundle price. And then, as you expect, these bundle prices tended to go up every year, which led to frustrated cable bundle customers facing ever-increasing monthly bills. But for the media companies, this was a great setup. They got to collect very high profit margin business with little risk of churn or the headaches of dealing with upset customers. You could see how this was too good to last.
I assume it didn't.
Yeah, that's right. And in the late 2000s, the second period starts. I'll call this the rise of Netflix. Netflix launched their streaming service in 2007. And initially, they moved very slowly. At first, they only licensed third-party content from the legacy media companies, and then they used this library of licensed content and a much lower monthly price point to steadily grow their subscriber base from 12 million in 2008 to 50 million by 2013. And then in 2013, Netflix jumped into the content production game with the hit show House of Cards. This proved that Netflix could produce and distribute high-quality content without the traditional media companies at all. Despite Netflix's early success with original content, traditional TV paid very little attention. So shows like Narcos, Orange is the New Black, and Stranger Things all showed that quality TV didn't have to cost as much or be bundled with hundreds of other channels. Accordingly, more and more legacy TV subscribers began to accelerate cutting the cord from traditional cable bundles. A new era was beginning where content and attention was moving away from traditional TV.
It's interesting that traditional companies fail to see Netflix's value to consumers.
Yeah, I know. It's quite confusing, actually. And this actually leads to the last period, which we'll call cable TV's fall and the streaming wars. So by the late 2010s, Disney, Paramount, Comcast Universal, Warner Brothers, Amazon, Apple, and a whole host of others were all trying to take Netflix head-on with their own streaming services. By 2019, cord cutting had brought cable's penetration down to just 63% of households subscribed. Remember, that number was 90% just 10 years earlier. And meanwhile, Netflix had grown their global subscriber base to over 150 million subscribers. The cable company's cash cow was shrinking fast, and they were playing catch-up now to Netflix's 10-year head start in streaming. The cable companies responded by pouring billions into content, technology, and advertising to try to grow their own streaming platforms. To give a sense for how aggressive content creation got during this period, in 2012, there were 300 U.S. TV shows produced. In 2022, this number ballooned to over 600 U.S. TV shows produced. This pace of content creation was unsustainable both financially and creatively. The legacy media companies lost billions in the process, while their cable business continued to melt.
Okay. So where are we today?
Yeah, after the initial focus on subscriber growth at any cost, media companies are now focusing more on profitability. Investors, in particular, want to see healthy growth and profits. So many legacy media companies are trying to right-size their streaming business to achieve profitable growth. There's been a lot of discussion around consolidation as well, which we are starting to see some signs of. For example, we saw at the start of 2025 a merger of Fubo and Disney's Hulu Live TV. Paramount has also agreed to be bought by an investor group led by Oracle CEO Larry Ellison's son. I suspect we're going to see a lot more M&A activity in this space in the years ahead. And meanwhile, Netflix continues to dominate the streaming market with over 300 million global subscribers at the end of 2024. And cable cord cutting is still continuing at a pace of about 5% per year.
Thanks for that. It's fascinating to hear the progression of how we got here. Based on their stock prices, it certainly seems that media companies are facing a lot of headwinds. As you look at the media landscape now, what do you think is the biggest problem they are facing?
Yeah, I think that the biggest challenge they face at the moment is keeping their content engaging to support retention and growth. There's so much competition for people's time now. Social media, video games, YouTube, other streamers, not to mention, you know, going outside or reading a book. Media companies are struggling to keep audiences engaged, and engagement is critical, not just for generating consistent monthly subscription fees, but also for selling ads, another key way to make money in streaming. Content needs to pull people back from wherever else they're spending their time to keep charging those monthly fees and to sell viewers' attention to advertisers. And important for profitability, that engaging content needs to be made efficiently.
You've mentioned profitability a few times, so I wanted to provide additional numbers for the audience. In 2013, at the height of their earnings power, Disney's media's business had an operating margin of 34% and contributed two-thirds of the entire firm's profit. Today, those numbers are closer to 10% margins and about a third of the firm's profit. Disney's streaming business is making well over $20 billion in annual revenue, but just barely started making a profit in 2024. Clearly, there's a lot of work for management to fully replace the lost profits of the traditional media business with streaming. Jake, how is Disney and the other media companies going to fill the gap in profitability?
That's a great question. And to be honest with you, the jury's still out on how successful the legacy media companies will be in replacing those lost profits from linear. But they're certainly trying. Staying with Disney for a moment, as you highlighted, their linear business was a huge profit center for the business before cord cutting picked up. 2015 was actually the peak for Disney's TV business profit. They made close to $8 billion in operating income from their media networks that year. In 2024, those same businesses are making only about $6 billion, leaving a $2 billion gap from where they were 10 years ago. So if Disney's streaming is expected to bring in $25 billion in revenue in 2025, holding everything else constant, they need to hit 8% margins just to fill that gap back to 2015. It's not out of the realm of possibility at all, but I think it's still a ways off. As you said, Disney's streaming business has just started to make a tiny profit, but Disney management is confident in the future. At the end of 2024, they announced ambitious guidance numbers, including getting streaming to roughly $1 billion in operating income in 2025. This would equal a margin of about 4%. It's a great improvement, but there's still room to expand further. And to be sure, Netflix just turned in 30% operating margins at the end of 2024. If nothing else, it shows that it is possible to make meaningful profits in this business.
How are the streamers that aren't Netflix going to get there?
That's another great question. You know, the legacy media companies have a few options, and they've been employing a bunch of these already, but they still have a lot more work to do. The first is cost cutting. So in 2020 and 2021, Wall Street was rewarding subscriber growth at all costs, and this led to massive investment in content and promotion to try to grow subscriber numbers as fast as possible. This growth at all cost period ended when Netflix subscriber numbers disappointed in the first quarter of 2022. This was a wake-up call for the industry that subscriber growth eventually slows and profitability was also important. Keeping content and customer acquisition costs lower now will be key. On the revenue side, price increases will continue to be a key lever to drive growth, but they need to be careful. Companies need to continue to maintain that value perception for subscribers, and they can't allow pricing to get ahead of what consumers value the services at. Another significant development, including for Netflix, has been ad-supported tiers. So offering a lower monthly subscription rate in exchange for having some commercials play during shows and movies. For many years, no ads was seen as a benefit of streamers. But now, they are all using ads, just as Linear did, as a source of revenue. Ad tiers also offer a lower monthly cost, which hopefully can help with reducing churn. It's early for many of these efforts, but they're expected to play a larger role down the road. Another thing I already mentioned was bundling, which is another option. And similar to the bundles of the cable era, companies are combining services either internally, like Disney's bundle of Disney Plus, Hulu, and ESPN Plus, or mixing with other companies' offerings, like the Comcast StreamSaver bundle that combines Netflix, Peacock, and Apple TV for Comcast Internet subscribers. These bundles help spread out costs, reduce churn, and hopefully attract new customers.
I've heard this term, churn, used a lot. What does it mean, and how are these companies addressing it?
Yeah, churn is the scourge of all streamers. In an ideal world, a subscriber would sign up once for a service and then pay their monthly bill forever. But in practice, customers drop in and out of services all the time. Today, churning is as easy as clicking a button on your phone or your connected TV. This is a lot different than calling into a call center like you had to do to change your cable offering. This is again why having the right balance of content and technology to keep subscribers engaged is so critical.
So what are some of the strategies streamers do to reduce churn?
Well, as I said, they need to produce a steady stream of engaging content, but they also have to have the right technology to put that content in front of users. This is what Netflix is great at, actually. They have found a groove of putting out a steady stream of content in a cost-effective way, so each week there's something interesting to check out. And they use their algorithm to determine what shows to put in front of a user to keep them watching. Other services have struggled to find the right mix. Using Disney again as an example, they have leaned into more expensive IP-driven shows from Star Wars and Marvel. They've struggled with inconsistent quality for a lot of these shows, and they've also struggled with keeping older audiences engaged in between these releases. Families with children really can't get rid of Disney Plus, but adults who just like Star Wars don't really need to keep the service once they're done with the latest season of The Mandalorian. This is one reason why Disney spreads out series over multiple weeks, in contrast to Netflix, who favors dropping an entire season at once, allowing viewers to binge and then move on to something new. Churn is a serious problem because it keeps consumer acquisition costs high, and these additional marketing, technology, and content costs eat into the profitability of the business. It is much more profitable to just keep all your existing subs and grow on top of that base. And actually, Yoshi, I wanted to ask you a question, particularly on the topic of building quality, engaging content. I know you're a big fan of Star Wars and Marvel. How do you think Disney has handled those properties on Disney Plus? These are obviously the crown jewels of the Disney universe, but they've definitely struggled, it seems, to capitalize on this IP for their streaming service.
Well, I have two thoughts on this question, building on the value proposition of quality and volume. Disney launched a totally new service with only Disney properties. They needed a lot of volume to fill up Disney Plus. They could obviously fill some of that service with their existing library, but that only would go so far. They needed new attention-grabbing content to draw in subscribers. This demand for new content, along with COVID restrictions, put a huge strain on the studios, and unfortunately, quality suffered. You can really see this with the special effects in some of the movies and shows. This has definitely hurt some of Disney's IP, especially Star Wars. The other thought is they kind of became victims of their own success, giving the studio a sense of invincibility. I feel like this was especially true with Marvel. They seemed to feel like they could do no wrong and ran the studio unconventionally as a result. For example, they didn't have showrunners to oversee the production of the TV shows, believing instead that the story could be fleshed out later. Marvel believed that fans would continue to consume content like they did at the height of their success. They overextended and diluted the brands, leading to a lot of consumer fatigue. It seems like they're realizing the error of their ways and cutting back on the content, which also reduces the cost, since Marvel and Star Wars content is some of the most expensive to make in the industry. Hopefully this helps some of the profitability challenge you discussed earlier. Well, thank you, Jake. And we hope this gives you a brief overview of this industry and how we see the evolving landscape.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Yoshi.
The information provided in this recording is for informational purposes only. While Choate Investment Advisors makes every attempt to present accurate information, the information in this recording may not be appropriate for your specific circumstances, and it may become outdated over time. The views expressed on this podcast are personal opinions only and should not be construed as financial advice for your given situation. Moreover, the views expressed by our guests are not necessarily endorsed by Choate Investment Advisors, and Choate Investment Advisors may decide to select investments on a different basis at any time without prior notice. Finally, as everyone should know, past performance is not a guarantee of future performance.